of other European countries, where growth has already slowed considerably in recent decades. For the moment, it is less prominent in the United States, essentially because demographic growth there is higher than in Europe. But if growth ultimately slows more or less everywhere in the coming century, as the median demographic forecasts by the United Nations, corroborated by other economic forecasts, suggest it will, then inheritance will probably take on increased importance throughout the world. This does not imply, however, that the structure of inequality in the 21st century will be the same as in the 19th century, in part because the concentration of wealth is less extreme. There will probably be more small to medium rentiers and fewer extremely wealthy rentiers, at least in the short term, in part because the earned income hierarchy is expanding with the rise of the supermanager, and finally because wealth and income are more strongly correlated than in the past. In the 21st century, it is possible to be both a supermanager and a medium rentier. The new meritocratic order encourages this sort of thing, probably to the detriment of low and medium wage workers, especially those who own only a tiny amount of property, if any. Inheritance flows over the long run. I will begin at the beginning. In all societies, there are two main ways of accumulating wealth, through work or inheritance. How common is each of these in the top centiles and deciles of the wealth hierarchy? This is the key question. In Vautrin's lecture to Rastignac, discussed in Chapter 7, the answer is clear. Study and work cannot possibly lead to a comfortable and elegant life, and the only realistic strategy is to marry Mademoiselle Victorine and her inheritance. One of my primary goals in this work is to find out how closely 19th-century French society resembled the society described by Vautrin, and above all, to learn how and why this type of society evolved over time. It is useful to begin by examining the evolution of the annual flow of inheritances over the long run. That is, the total value of bequests and gifts between living individuals during the course of a year, expressed as a percentage of national income. This figure measures the annual amount of past wealth conveyed each year relative to the total income earned that year. Recall that earned income accounts for roughly two-thirds of national income each year, while part of capital income goes to remunerate the capital that is passed on to heirs. I will examine the French case, which is by far the best known over the long run, and the pattern I find there, it turns out, also applies to a certain extent to other European countries. Finally, I will explore what it is possible to say at the global level. PDF figure 11.1 represents the evolution of the annual inheritance flow in France from 1820 to 2010. Two facts stand out clearly. First, the inheritance flow accounts for 20 to 25% of annual income every year in the 19th century, with a slight upward trend toward the end of the century. This is an extremely high flow, as I will show later, and it reflects the fact that nearly all of the capital stock came from inheritance. If inherited wealth is omnipresent in 19th century novels, it was not only because writers, especially the debt-ridden Balzac, were obsessed by it. It was above all because inheritance occupied a structurally central place in 19th-century society, central as both economic flow and social force. Its importance did not diminish with time, moreover. On the contrary, in 1900 to 1910, the flow of inheritance was somewhat higher, 25% of national income, compared with barely 20 than it had been in the 1820s, the period of Vautrin, Rastignac, and the Vauquier boarding house. Subsequently, we find a spectacular decrease in the flow of inheritances between 1910 and 1950, followed by a steady rebound thereafter, with an acceleration in the 1980s. There were very large upward and downward variations during the 20th century. The annual flow of inheritances and gifts was, to a first approximation and compared with subsequent shocks, relatively stable until World War I, but fell by a factor of 5 or 6 between 1910 and 1950, when the inheritance flow was barely 4 or 5% of national income, after which it increased by a factor of 3 or 4 between 1950 and 2010, at which time the flow accounted for 15% of national income. The evolution visible in PDF figure 11.1 reflects deep changes in the perception as well as the reality of inheritance, and to a large extent, it also reflects changes in the structure of inequality. As we will soon see, the compression of the inheritance flow owing to the shocks of 1914 to 1945 was nearly twice as great as the decrease in private wealth. The inheritance collapse was therefore not simply the result of a wealth collapse, even if the two developments are obviously closely related. In the public mind, the idea that the age of inheritance was over was certainly even more influential than the idea of an end of capitalism. In 1950 to 1960, bequests and gifts accounted for just a few points of national income, so it was reasonable to think that inheritances had virtually disappeared and that capital, though less important overall than in the past, was now wealth that an individual accumulated by effort and saving during his or her lifetime. Several generations grew up under these conditions, even if perceptions somewhat exceeded reality. In particular, the baby boom generation, born in the late 1940s and early 1950s, many of whom are still alive today, and it was natural for them to assume that this was the new normal. Conversely, younger people, in particular those born in the 1970s and 1980s, have already experienced, to a certain extent, the important role that inheritance will once again play in their lives, and the lives of their relatives and friends. For this group, for example, whether or not a child receives gifts from parents can have a major impact in deciding who will own property and who will not, at what age, and how extensive that property will be, in any case, to a much greater extent than in the previous generation. Inheritance is playing a larger part in their lives, careers, and individual and family choices than it did with the baby boomers. The rebound of inheritance is still incomplete, however, and the evolution is still underway. The inheritance flow in 2000 to 2010 stood at a point roughly midway between the nadir of the 1950s and the peak of 1900 to 1910. To date, it has had a less profound impact on perceptions than the previous change, which still dominates people's thinking. A few decades from now, things may be very different. Fiscal flow and economic flow. Several points about PDF figure 11.1 need to be clarified. First, it is essential to include gifts between living individuals, whether shortly before death or earlier in life, in the flow of inheritance, because this form of transmission has always played a very important role in France and elsewhere. The relative magnitude of gifts and bequests has varied greatly over time, so omitting gifts would seriously bias the analysis and distort spatial and temporal comparisons. Fortunately, gifts in France are carefully recorded, though no doubt somewhat underestimated. This is not the case everywhere. Second, and even more important, the wealth of French historical sources allows us to calculate inheritance flows in two different ways, using data and methods that are totally independent. What we find is that the two evolutions shown in PDF figure 11.1, which I have labeled fiscal flow and economic flow, are highly consistent, which is reassuring and demonstrates the robustness of the historical data. This consistency also helps us to decompose and analyze the various forces at work. Broadly speaking, there are two ways to estimate inheritance flows in a particular country. One can make direct use of observed flows of inheritances and gifts, for example, by using tax data. This is what I call the fiscal flow. Or one can look at the private capital stock and calculate the theoretical flow that must have occurred in a given year, which I call the economic flow. Each method has its advantages and disadvantages. The first method is more direct, but the tax data in many countries are so incomplete that the results are not always satisfactory. In France, as noted previously, the system for recording bequests and gifts was established exceptionally early, at the time of the Revolution, and is unusually comprehensive. In theory, it covers all transmissions, including those on which little or no tax is paid, though there are some exceptions, so the fiscal method can be applied. The tax data must be corrected, however, to take account of small bequests that do not have to be declared. The amounts involved are insignificant, and above all to correct for certain assets that are exempt from the estate tax, such as life insurance contracts, which have become increasingly common since 1970, and today account for nearly one-sixth of total private wealth in France. The second method, economic flow, has the advantage of not relying on tax data, and therefore giving a more complete picture of the transmission of wealth, independent of the vagaries of different countries' tax systems. The ideal is to be able to use both methods in the same country. What is more, one can interpret the gap between the two curves in PDF Figure 11.1, which shows that the economic flow is always a little greater than the fiscal flow, as an estimate of tax fraud or deficiencies of the probate record-keeping system. There may also be other reasons for the gap, including the many imperfections in the available data sets and the methods used. For certain sub-periods, the gap is far from negligible. The long-run evolutions in which I am primarily interested are nevertheless quite consistent, regardless of which method we use. The three forces. The illusion of an end of inheritance. In fact, the main advantage of the economic flow approach is that it requires us to take a comprehensive view of the three forces that everywhere determine the flow of inheritance and its historical evolution. In general, the annual economic flow of inheritances and gifts, expressed as a proportion of national income that we denote B sub Y, is equal to the product of three forces. B sub Y equals mu times M times beta, where beta is the capital income ratio, or more precisely, the ratio of total private wealth, which, unlike public assets, can be passed on by inheritance to national income. M is the mortality rate, and mu is the ratio of average wealth at time of death to average wealth of living individuals. This decomposition is a pure accounting identity. By definition, it is always true in all times and places. In particular, this is the formula I used to estimate the economic flow depicted in PDF Figure 11.1. Although this decomposition of the economic flow into three forces is a tautology, I think it is a useful tautology in that it enables us to clarify an issue that has been the source of much confusion in the past, even though the underlying logic is not terribly complex. Let me examine the three forces one by one. The first is the capital income ratio, beta. This force expresses a truism. If the flow of inherited wealth is to be high in a given society, the total stock of private wealth capable of being inherited must also be large. The second force, the mortality rate M, describes an equally transparent mechanism. All other things being equal, the higher the mortality rate, the higher the inheritance flow. In a society where everyone lives forever, so that the mortality rate is exactly zero, inheritance must vanish. The inheritance flow B sub Y must also be zero, no matter how large the capital income ratio beta is. The third force, the ratio mu of average wealth at time of death to average wealth of living individuals, is equally transparent. Suppose that the average wealth at time of death is the same as the average wealth of the population as a whole. Then mu equals 1, and the inheritance flow, B sub Y, is simply the product of the mortality rate M and the capital income ratio, beta. For example, if the capital income ratio is 600%, that is, the stock of private wealth represents 6 years of national income, and the mortality rate of the adult population is 2%, then the annual inheritance flow will automatically be 12% of national income. If average wealth at time of death is twice the average wealth of the living, so that mu equals 2, then the inheritance flow will be 24% of national income, assuming beta equals 6 and m equals 2%, which is approximately the level observed in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Clearly, mu depends on the age profile of wealth. The more wealth increases with age, the higher mu will be, and therefore, the larger the inheritance flow. Conversely, in a society where the primary purpose of wealth is to finance retirement, and elderly individuals consume the capital accumulated during their working lives in their years of retirement by drawing down savings in a pension fund, for example, in accordance with the life cycle theory of wealth, developed by the Italian-American economist Franco Modigliani in the 1950s, then by construction, mu will be almost zero, since everyone aims to die with little or no capital. In the extreme case, mu equals zero, inheritance vanishes regardless of the values of beta and m. In strictly logical terms, it is perfectly possible to imagine a world in which there is considerable private wealth. So beta is very high. But most wealth is in pension funds or equivalent forms of wealth that vanish at death, annuitized wealth, so that the inheritance flow is zero or close to it. Modigliani's theory offers a tranquil, one-dimensional view of social inequality. Inequalities of wealth are nothing more than a translation in time of inequalities with respect to work. Managers accumulate more retirement savings than workers, but both groups consume all their capital by the time they die. This theory was quite popular in the decades after World War II, when functionalist American sociology, exemplified by the work of Talcott Parsons, also depicted a middle-class society of managers in which inherited wealth played virtually no role. It is still quite popular today among baby boomers. Our decomposition of the inheritance flow as the product of three forces, B sub Y equals mu times M times beta, is important for thinking historically about inheritance and its evolution, for each of the three forces embodies a significant set of beliefs and arguments, perfectly plausible a priori, that led many people to imagine, especially during the optimistic decades after World War II, that the end, or at any rate gradual and progressive decrease, of inherited wealth was somehow the logical and natural culmination of history. However, such a gradual end to inherited wealth is by no means inevitable, as the French case clearly illustrates. Indeed, the U-shaped curve we see in France is a consequence of three U-shaped curves describing each of the three forces, mu, m, and beta. Furthermore, the three forces acted simultaneously, in part for accidental reasons, and this explains the large amplitude of the overall change, and in particular the exceptionally low level of inheritance flow in 1950 to 1960, which led many people to believe that inherited wealth had virtually disappeared. In part two, I showed that the capital income ratio beta was indeed described by a U-shaped curve. The optimistic belief associated with this first force is quite clear, and at first sight perfectly plausible. Inherited wealth has tended over time to lose its importance simply because wealth has lost its importance, or more precisely, wealth in the sense of non-human capital, that is, wealth that can be owned, exchanged on a market, and fully transmitted to heirs under the prevailing laws of property. There is no logical reason why this optimistic belief cannot be correct, and it permeates the whole modern theory of human capital, including the work of Gary Becker, even if it is not always explicitly formulated. However, things did not unfold this way, or at any rate not to the degree that people sometimes imagine. Landed capital became financial and industrial capital and real estate, but retained its overall importance, as can be seen in the fact that the capital income ratio seems to be about to regain the record level attained in the Belle Époque and earlier. For partly technological reasons, capital still plays a central role in production today, and therefore in social life. Before production can begin, funds are needed for equipment and office space, to finance material and immaterial investments of all kinds, and of course to pay for housing. To be sure, the level of human skill and competence has increased over time, but the importance of non-human capital has increased proportionately. Hence, there is no obvious a priori reason to expect the gradual disappearance of inherited wealth on these grounds. Mortality over the long run. The second force that might explain the natural end of inheritance is increased life expectancy, which lowers the mortality rate M and increases the time to inheritance, which decreases the size of the legacy. Indeed, there is no doubt that the mortality rate has decreased over the long run. The proportion of the population that dies each year is smaller when the life expectancy is 80 than when it is 60. Other things being equal, for a given beta and mu, a society with a lower mortality rate is also a society in which the flow of inheritance is a smaller proportion of national income. In France, the mortality rate has declined inexorably over the course of history. And the same is true of other countries. The French mortality rate was around 2.2% of the adult population in the 19th century, but declined steadily throughout the 20th century, dropping to 1.1% to 1.2% in 2000 to 2010, a decrease of almost one-half in a century. See PDF figure 11.2. It would be a serious mistake, however, to think that changes in the mortality rate lead inevitably to the disappearance of inherited wealth as a major factor in the economy. For one thing, the mortality rate began to rise again in France in 2000 to 2010. And according to official demographic forecasts, this increase is likely to continue until 2040 to 2050, after which adult mortality should stabilize at around 1.4 to 1.5%. The explanation for this is that the baby boomers, who outnumber previous cohorts, but are about the same size as subsequent ones, will reach the end of their lifespans in this period. In other words, the baby boom, which led to a structural increase in the size of birth cohorts, temporarily reduced the mortality rate simply because the population grew younger and larger. French demographics are fortunately quite simple, so that it is possible to present the principal effects of demographic change in a clear manner. In the 19th century, the population was virtually stationary, and life expectancy was about 60 years, so that the average person enjoyed a little over 40 years of adulthood, and the mortality rate was therefore close to 1 over 40, or actually about 2.2%. In the 21st century, the population, according to official forecasts, will likely stabilize again, with a life expectancy of about 85 years, or about 65 years of adult life, giving a mortality rate of about 1 over 65 in a static population, which translates into 1.4 to 1.5% when we allow for slight demographic growth. Over the long run, in a developed country with a quasi-stagnant population like France, where population increase is primarily due to aging, the decrease in the adult mortality rate is about one-third. The anticipated increase in the mortality rate between 2000 to 2010 and 2040 to 2050 due to the aging of the baby boom generation is admittedly a purely mathematical effect, but it is nevertheless important. It partly explains the low inheritance flows of the second half of the 20th century, as well as the expected sharp increase in these flows in the decades to come. This effect will be even stronger elsewhere. In countries where the population has begun to decrease significantly, or will soon do so, owing to a decrease in cohort size, most notably Germany, Italy, Spain, and of course Japan, this phenomenon will lead to a much larger increase in the adult mortality rate in the first half of the 21st century, and thus automatically increase inheritance flows by a considerable amount. People may live longer, but they still die eventually. Only a significant and steady increase in cohort size can permanently reduce the mortality rate and inheritance flow. When an aging population is combined with a stabilization of cohort size, as in France, however, or even a reduced cohort size, as in a number of rich countries, very high inheritance flows are possible. In the extreme case, a country in which the cohort size is reduced by half, because each couple decides to have only one child, the mortality rate, and therefore the inheritance flow, could rise to unprecedented levels. Conversely, in a country where the size of each age cohort doubles every generation, as happened in many countries in the 20th century, and is still happening in Africa, the mortality rate declines to very low levels, and inherited wealth counts for little, other things equal. Wealth ages with population. The mu times m effect. Let us now forget the effects of variations in cohort size. Though important, they are essentially transitory, unless we imagine that in the long run the population of the planet grows infinitely large or infinitely small. Instead, I will adopt the very long-run perspective and assume that cohort size is stable. How does increased life expectancy really affect the importance of inherited wealth? To be sure, a longer life expectancy translates into a structural decrease in the mortality rate. In France, where the average life expectancy in the 21st century will be 8 to 85 years, the adult mortality rate will stabilize at less than 1.5% a year, compared with 2.2% in the 19th century, when the life expectancy was just over 60. The increase in the average age of death inevitably gives rise to a similar increase in the average age of heirs at the moment of inheritance. In the 19th century, the average age of inheritance was just 30. In the 21st century, it will be somewhere around 50. As PDF figure 11.3 shows, the difference between the average age of death and the average age of inheritance has always been around 30 years, for the simple reason that the average age of childbirth, often referred to as generational duration, has been relatively stable at around 30 over the long run, although there has been a slight increase in the early 21st century. But does the fact that people die later and inherit later imply that inherited wealth is losing its importance? Not necessarily, in part because the growing importance of gifts between living individuals has partly compensated for this aging effect, and in part because it may be that people are inheriting later but receiving larger amounts, since wealth tends to age in an aging society. In other words, the downward trend in the mortality rate, ineluctable in the very long run, can be compensated by a similar structural increase in the relative wealth of older people, so that the product mu times m remains unchanged, or, in any case, falls much more slowly than some have believed. This is precisely what happened in France. The ratio mu of average wealth at death to average wealth of the living rose sharply after 1950 to 1960. And this gradual aging of wealth explains much of the increased importance of inherited wealth in recent decades. Concretely, one finds that the product mu times m, which by definition measures the annual rate of transmission by inheritance, or, in other words, the inheritance flow expressed as a percentage of total private wealth, clearly began to rise over the past few decades, despite the continuing decrease in the mortality rate, as PDF figure 11.4 shows. The annual rate of transmission by inheritance, which 19th century economists called the rate of estate devolution, was, according to my sources, relatively stable from the 1820s to the 1910s at around 3.3 to 3.5%, or roughly 1 over 30. It was also said in those days that a fortune was inherited on average once every 30 years, that is, once a generation, which is a somewhat too static view of things, but partially justified by the reality of the time. The transmission rate decreased sharply in the period 1910 to 1950, and in the 1950s stood at about 2% before rising steadily to above 2.5% in 2000 to 2010. To sum up, Inheritance occurs later in aging societies. But wealth also ages, and the latter tends to compensate the former. In this sense, a society in which people die older is very different from a society in which they don't die at all, and inheritance effectively vanishes. Increased life expectancy delays important life events. People study longer, start work later, inherit later, retire later, and die later. But the relative importance of inherited wealth as opposed to earned income does not necessarily change, or at any rate changes much less than people sometimes imagine. To be sure, inheriting later in life may make choosing a profession more frequently necessary than in the past, but this is compensated by the inheritance of larger amounts or by the receipt of gifts. In any case, the difference is more one of degree than the dramatic change of civilization that is sometimes imagined. Wealth of the dead, wealth of the living. It is interesting to take a closer look at the evolution of mu, the ratio between average wealth at death and average wealth of the living, which I have presented in PDF figure 11.5. Note first that over the course of the past two centuries, from 1820 to the present, the dead have always been, on average, wealthier than the living in France. Mu has always been greater than 100%, except in the period around World War II, 1940 to 1950, when the ratio, without correcting for gifts made prior to death, fell to just below 100%. Recall that according to Modigliani's life cycle theory, the primary reason for amassing wealth, especially in aging societies, is to pay for retirement, so that older individuals should consume most of their savings during old age, and should therefore die with little or no wealth. This is the famous Modigliani triangle, taught to all students of economics, according to which wealth at first increases with age, as individuals accumulate savings, in anticipation of retirement, and then decreases. The ratio mu should therefore be equal to zero, or close to it. In any case, much less than 100%. But this theory of capital and its evolution in advanced societies, which is perfectly plausible a priori, cannot explain the observed facts, to put it mildly. Clearly, saving for retirement is only one of many reasons, and not the most important reason, why people accumulate wealth. The desire to perpetuate the family fortune has always played a central role. In practice, the various forms of annuitized wealth, which cannot be passed on to descendants, account for less than 5% of private wealth in France, and at most 15 to 20% in the English-speaking countries, where pension funds are more developed. This is not a negligible amount, but it is not enough to alter the fundamental importance of inheritance as a motive for wealth accumulation, especially since life cycle savings may not be a substitute for, but rather a supplement to transmissible wealth. To be sure, it is quite difficult to say how different wealth accumulation would have been in the 20th century in the absence of pay-as-you-go public pension systems, which guaranteed the vast majority of retirees a decent standard of living in a more reliable and equitable way than investment in financial assets, which plummeted after the war, could have done. It is possible that without such public pension systems, the overall level of wealth accumulation, measured by the capital-income ratio, would have been even greater than it is today. In any case, the capital-income ratio is approximately the same today as it was in the Belle Époque, when a shorter life expectancy greatly reduced the need to accumulate savings in anticipation of retirement, and annuitized wealth accounts for only a slightly larger portion of total wealth than it did a century ago. Note also the importance of gifts between living individuals over the past two centuries, as well as their spectacular rise over the past several decades. The total annual value of gifts was 30 to 40% of the annual value of inheritances from 1820 to 1870, during which time gifts came mainly in the form of dowries, that is, gifts to the spouse at the time of marriage, often with restrictions specified in the marriage contract. Between 1870 and 1970, the value of gifts decreased slightly, stabilizing at about 20 to 30% of inheritances, before increasing strongly and steadily to 40% in the 1980s, 60% in the 1990s, and more than 80% in 2000 to 2010. Today, transmission of capital by gift is nearly as important as transmission by inheritance. Gifts account for almost half of present inheritance flows, and it is therefore essential to take them into account. Concretely, if gifts prior to death were not included, we would find that average wealth at death in 2000 to 2010 was just over 20% higher than average wealth of the living. But this is simply a reflection of the fact that the dead have already passed on nearly half of their assets. If we include gifts made prior to death, we find that the corrected value of mu is actually greater than 220%. The corrected wealth of the dead is nearly twice as great as that of the living. We are once again living in a golden age of gift-giving, much more so than in the 19th century. It is interesting to note that the vast majority of gifts, today as in the 19th century, go to children, often in the context of a real estate investment, and they are given on average about 10 years before the death of the donor, a gap that has remained relatively stable over time. The growing importance of gifts since the 1970s has led to a decrease in the average age of the recipient. In 2000 to 2010, the average age of an heir is 45 to 50, while that of the recipient of a gift is 35 to 40. So that the difference between today and the 19th or early 20th centuries is not as great as it seems from PDF figure 11.3. The most convincing explanation of this gradual and progressive increase of gift-giving, which began in the 1970s, well before fiscal incentives were put in place in 1990 to 2000, is that parents with means gradually became aware that owing to the increase in life expectancy, there might be good reasons to share their wealth with their children at the age of 35 to 40 rather than 45 to 50 or even later. In any case, whatever the exact role of each of the various possible explanations, the fact is that the upsurge in gift-giving, which we also find in other European countries, including Germany, is an essential ingredient in the revived importance of inherited wealth in contemporary society. The 50s and the 80s. Age and fortune in the Belle Époque. In order to better understand the dynamics of wealth accumulation and the detailed data used to calculate mu, it is useful to examine the evolution of the average wealth profile as a function of age. PDF Table 11.1 presents wealth age profiles for a number of years between 1820 and 2010. The most striking fact is no doubt the impressive aging of wealth throughout the 19th century, as capital became increasingly concentrated. In 1820, the elderly were barely wealthier, on average, than people in their 50s, which I have taken as a reference group. Sexagenarians were 34% wealthier, and octogenarians 53% wealthier. But the gaps widened steadily thereafter. By 1900 to 1910, the average wealth of sexagenarians and septuagenarians was on the order of 60 to 80% higher than the reference group, and octogenarians were 2.5 times wealthier. Note that these are averages for all of France. If we restrict our attention to Paris, where the largest fortunes were concentrated, the situation is even more extreme. On the eve of World War I, Parisian fortunes swelled with age, with septuagenarians and octogenarians, on average, 3 or even 4 times as wealthy as 50-year-olds. To be sure, the majority of people died with no wealth at all, and the absence of any pension system tended to aggravate this golden age poverty. But among the minority with some fortune, the aging of wealth is quite impressive. Quite clearly, the spectacular enrichment of octogenarians cannot be explained by income from labor or entrepreneurial activity. It is hard to imagine people in their 80s creating a new startup every morning. This enrichment of the elderly is striking, in part because it explains the high value of mu, the ratio of average wealth at time of death to average wealth of the living in the Belle Époque, and therefore the high inheritance flows, and even more because it tells us something quite specific about the underlying economic process. The individual data we have are quite clear on this point. The very rapid increase of wealth among the elderly in the late 19th and early 20th centuries was a straightforward consequence of the inequality R is greater than G, and of the cumulative and multiplicative logic it implies. Concretely, elderly people with the largest fortunes often enjoyed capital incomes far in excess of what they needed to live. Suppose, for example, that they obtained a return of 5% and consumed 2/5 of their capital income while reinvesting the other 3/5. Their wealth would then have grown at a rate of 3% a year, and by the age of 85, they would have been more than twice as rich as they were at age 60. The mechanism is simple, but extremely powerful, and it explains the observed facts very well, except that the people with the largest fortunes could often save more than 3/5 of their capital income, which would have accelerated the divergence process, and the general growth of mean income and wealth was not quite zero, but about 1% a year, which would have slowed it down a bit. The study of the dynamics of accumulation and concentration of wealth in France in 1870 to 1914, especially in Paris, has many lessons to teach about the world today and in the future. Not only are the data exceptionally detailed and reliable, but this period is also emblematic of the first globalization of trade and finance. As noted, it had modern, diversified capital markets, and individuals held complex portfolios consisting of domestic and foreign, public and private assets, paying fixed and variable amounts. To be sure, economic growth was only 1 to 1.5% a year, but such a growth rate, as I showed earlier, is actually quite substantial from a generational standpoint, or in the historical perspective of the very long run. It is by no means indicative of a static agricultural society. This was an era of technological and industrial innovation. The automobile, electricity, the cinema, and many other novelties became important in these years, and many of them originated in France, at least in part. Between 1870 and 1914, not all fortunes of 50 and 60-year-olds were inherited. Far from it. We find a considerable number of wealthy people who made their money through entrepreneurial activities in industry and finance. Nevertheless, the dominant dynamic which explains most of the concentration of wealth was an inevitable consequence of the inequality R is greater than G. Regardless of whether the wealth a person holds at age 50 or 60 is inherited or earned, the fact remains that beyond a certain threshold, capital tends to reproduce itself and accumulates exponentially. The logic of R is greater than G implies that the entrepreneur always tends to turn into a rentier. Even if this happens later in life, the phenomenon becomes important as life expectancy increases. The fact that a person has good ideas at age 30 or 40 does not imply that she will still be having them at 70 or 80. Yet her wealth will continue to increase by itself, or it can be passed on to the next generation and continue to increase there. 19th century French economic elites were creative and dynamic entrepreneurs, but the crucial fact remains that their efforts ultimately, and largely unwittingly, reinforced and perpetuated a society of rentiers owing to the logic of R is greater than G. The rejuvenation of wealth owing to war. This self-sustaining mechanism collapsed owing to the repeated shocks suffered by capital and its owners in the period 1914 to 1945. A significant rejuvenation of wealth was one consequence of the two world wars. One sees this clearly in PDF figure 11.5. For the first time in history, and to this day the only time, average wealth at death in 1940 to 1950 fell below the average wealth of the living. This fact emerges even more clearly in the detailed profiles by age cohort in PDF Table 11.1. In 1912, on the eve of World War I, octogenarians were more than 2.5 times as wealthy as people in their 50s. In 1931, they were only 50% wealthier. And in 1947, the 50-somethings were 40% wealthier than the 80-somethings. To add insult to injury, the octogenarians even fell slightly behind people in their 40s in that year. This was a period in which all old certainties were called into question. In the years after World War II, the plot of wealth versus age suddenly took the form of a bell curve, with a peak in the 50 to 59 age bracket, a form close to the Modigliani triangle, except for the fact that wealth did not fall to zero at the most advanced ages. This stands in sharp contrast to the 19th century, during which the wealth age curve was monotonically increasing with age. There is a simple explanation for this spectacular rejuvenation of wealth. As noted in Part 2, all fortunes suffered multiple shocks in the period 1914 to 1945. Destruction of property, inflation, bankruptcy, expropriation, and so on. So that the capital-income ratio fell sharply. To a first approximation, one might assume that all fortunes suffered to the same degree, leaving the age profile unchanged. In fact, however, the younger generations, which in any case did not have much to lose, recovered more quickly from these wartime shocks than their elders did. A person who was 60 years old in 1940 and lost everything he owned in a bombardment, expropriation, or bankruptcy had little hope of recovering. He would likely have died between 1950 and 1960 at the age of 70 or 80, with nothing to pass on to his heirs. Conversely, a person who was 30 in 1940 and lost everything, which was probably not much, still had plenty of time to accumulate wealth after the war, and by the 1950s would have been in his 40s and wealthier than that septuagenarian. The war reset all counters to zero, or close to zero, and inevitably resulted in a rejuvenation of wealth. In this respect, it was indeed the two world wars that wiped the slate clean in the 20th century and created the illusion that capitalism had been overcome. This is the central explanation for the exceptionally low inheritance flows observed in the decades after World War II. Individuals who should have inherited fortunes in 1950 to 1960 did not inherit much, because their parents had not had time to recover from the shocks of the previous decades, and died without much wealth to their names. In particular, this argument enables us to understand why the collapse of inheritance flows was greater than the collapse of wealth itself, nearly twice as large, in fact. As I showed in Part 2, total private wealth fell by more than two-thirds, between 1910 to 1920 and 1950 to 1960. The private capital stock decreased from 7 years of national income to just 2 to 2.5 years. See PDF Figure 3.6. The annual flow of inheritance fell by almost 5/6, from 25% of national income on the eve of World War I to just 4 to 5% in the 1950s. See PDF Figure 11.1. The crucial fact, however, is that this situation did not last long. Reconstruction capitalism was by its nature a transitional phase, and not the structural transformation some people imagined. In 1950 to 1960, as capital was once again accumulated and the capital-income ratio beta rose, fortunes began to age once more, so that the ratio mu between average wealth at death and average wealth of the living also increased. Growing wealth went hand in hand with aging wealth, thereby laying the groundwork for an even stronger comeback of inherited wealth. By 1960, the profile observed in 1947 was already a memory. Sexagenarians and septuagenarians were slightly wealthier than people in their 50s. See PDF Table 11.1. The octogenarians' turn came in the 1980s. In 1990 to 2000, the graph of wealth against age was increasing even more steeply. By 2010, the average wealth of people in their 80s was more than 30% higher than that of people in their 50s. If one were to include, which PDF Table 11.1 does not, gifts made prior to death in the wealth of different age cohorts, the graph for 2000 to 2010 would be steeper still, approximately the same as in 1900 to 1910, with average wealth for people in their 70s and 80s on the order of twice as great as people in their 50s, except that most deaths now occur at a more advanced age, which yields a considerably higher mu. See PDF Figure 11.5. How will inheritance flows evolve in the 21st century? In view of the rapid increase of inheritance flows in recent decades, it is natural to ask if this increase is likely to continue. PDF Figure 11.6 shows two possible evolutions for the 21st century. The central scenario is based on the assumption of an annual growth rate of 1.7% for the period 2010 to 2100, and a net return on capital of 3%. The alternative scenario is based on the assumption that growth will be reduced to 1% for the period 2010 to 2100, while the return on capital will rise to 5%. This could happen, for instance, if all taxes on capital and capital income, including the corporate income tax, were eliminated, or if such taxes were reduced while capital's share of income increased. In the central scenario, simulations based on the theoretical model, which successfully accounts for the evolutions of 1820 to 2010, suggest that the annual inheritance flow would continue to grow until 2030 to 2040, and then stabilize at around 16 to 17% of national income. According to the alternative scenario, the inheritance flow should increase even more until 2060 to 2070, and then stabilize at around 24 to 25% of national income, a level similar to that observed in 1870 to 1910. In the first case, inherited wealth would make only a partial comeback. In the second, its comeback would be complete as far as the total amount of inheritances and gifts is concerned. In both cases, the flow of inheritances and gifts in the 21st century is expected to be quite high, and in particular, much higher than it was during the exceptionally low phase observed in the mid-20th century. Such predictions are obviously highly uncertain, and are of interest primarily for their illustrative value. The evolution of inheritance flows in the 21st century depends on many economic, demographic, and political factors, and history shows that these are subject to large and highly unpredictable changes. It is easy to imagine other scenarios that would lead to different outcomes. For instance, a spectacular acceleration of demographic or economic growth, which seems rather implausible, or a radical change in public policy in regard to private capital or inheritance, which may be more realistic. It is also important to note that the evolution of the wealth age profile depends primarily on savings behavior, that is, on the reasons why different groups of people accumulate wealth. As already discussed at some length, there are many such reasons, and their relative importance varies widely from individual to individual. One may save in anticipation of retirement or job loss, life cycle or precautionary saving. Or one may save to amass or perpetuate a family fortune. Or indeed, one may simply have a taste for wealth and the prestige that sometimes goes with it, dynastic saving or pure accumulation. In the abstract, it is perfectly possible to imagine a world in which all people would choose to convert all of their wealth into annuities and die with nothing. If such behavior were suddenly to become predominant in the 21st century, inheritance flows would obviously shrink to virtually zero, regardless of the growth rate or return on capital. Nevertheless, the two scenarios presented in PDF Figure 11.6 are the most plausible in light of currently available information. In particular, I have assumed that savings behavior in 2010 to 2100 will remain similar to what it has been in the past, which can be characterized as follows. Despite wide variations in individual behavior, we find that savings rates increase with income and initial endowment, but variations by age group are much smaller. To a first approximation, people save on average at a similar rate regardless of age. In particular, the massive dis-saving by the elderly predicted by the life cycle theory of saving does not seem to occur, no matter how much life expectancy increases. The reason for this is no doubt the importance of the family transmission motive. No one really wants to die with nothing, even in aging societies. Together with a logic of pure accumulation, as well as the sense of security, and not merely prestige or power, that wealth brings. The very high concentration of wealth, with the upper decile always owning at least 50% to 60% of all wealth, even within each age cohort, is the missing link that explains all these facts, which Modigliani's theory totally overlooks. The gradual return to a dynastic type of wealth inequality since 1950 to 1960 explains the absence of dis-saving by the elderly. Most wealth belongs to individuals who have the means to finance their lifestyles without selling assets. And therefore, the persistence of high inheritance flows and the perpetuation of the new equilibrium in which mobility, though positive, is limited. The essential point is that for a given structure of savings behavior, the cumulative process becomes more rapid and inegalitarian as the return on capital rises and the growth rate falls. The very high growth of the three post-war decades explains the relatively slow increase of mu, the ratio of average wealth at death to average wealth of the living, and therefore of inheritance flows in the period 1950 to 1970. Conversely, slower growth explains the accelerated aging of wealth and the rebound of inherited wealth that have occurred since the 1980s. Intuitively, when growth is high, for example, when wages increase 5% a year, it is easier for younger generations to accumulate wealth and level the playing field with their elders. When the growth of wages drops to 1 to 2% a year, the elderly will inevitably acquire most of the available assets, and their wealth will increase at a rate determined by the return on capital. This simple but important process explains very well the evolution of the ratio mu and the annual inheritance flow. It also explains why the observed and simulated series are so close for the entire period 1820 to 2010. Uncertainties notwithstanding, it is therefore natural to think that these simulations provide a useful guide for the future. Theoretically, one can show that for a large class of savings behaviors, when growth is low compared to the return on capital, the increase in mu nearly exactly balances the decrease in the mortality rate m, so that the product mu times m is virtually independent of life expectancy and is almost entirely determined by the duration of a generation. The central result is that a growth of about 1% is in this respect not very different from zero growth. In both cases, the intuition that an aging population will spend down its savings and thus put an end to inherited wealth turns out to be false. In an aging society, heirs come into their inheritances later in life, but inherit larger amounts, at least for those who inherit anything. So the overall importance of inherited wealth remains unchanged. From the annual inheritance flow to the stock of inherited wealth. How does one go from the annual inheritance flow to the stock of inherited wealth? The detailed data assembled on inheritance flows and ages of the deceased, their heirs and gift givers and recipients, enable us to estimate for each year in the period 1820 to 2010 the share of inherited wealth in the total wealth of individuals alive in that year. The method is essentially to add up bequests and gifts received over the previous 30 years, sometimes more in the case of particularly early inheritances, or exceptionally long lives, or less in the opposite case, and thus to determine the share of inherited wealth in total private wealth. The principal results are indicated in PDF Figure 11.7, where I also show the results of simulations for the period 2010 to 2100, based on the two scenarios discussed above. The orders of magnitude to bear in mind are the following. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, when the annual inheritance flow was 20 to 25% of national income, inherited wealth accounted for nearly all private wealth, somewhere between 80 and 90%, with an upward trend. Note, however, that in all societies, at all levels of wealth, a significant number of wealthy individuals, between 10 and 20%, accumulate fortunes during their lifetimes, having started with nothing. Nevertheless, inherited wealth accounts for the vast majority of cases. This should come as no surprise. If one adds up an annual inheritance flow of 20% of national income for approximately 30 years, one accumulates a very large sum of legacies and gifts, on the order of 6 years of national income, which thus accounts for nearly all of private wealth. Over the course of the 20th century, following the collapse of inheritance flows, this equilibrium changed dramatically. The low point was attained in the 1970s. After several decades of small inheritances and accumulation of new wealth, inherited capital accounted for just over 40% of total private capital. For the first time in history, except in new countries, wealth accumulated in the lifetime of the living constituted the majority of all wealth, nearly 60%. It is important to realize two things. First, the nature of capital effectively changed in the post-war period. And second, we are just emerging from this exceptional period. Nevertheless, we are now clearly out of it. The share of inherited wealth in total wealth has grown steadily since the 1970s. Inherited wealth once again accounted for the majority of wealth in the 1980s, and according to the latest available figures, it represents roughly two-thirds of private capital in France in 2010, compared with barely one-third of capital accumulated from savings. In view of today's very high inheritance flows, it is quite likely, if current trends continue, that the share of inherited wealth will continue to grow in the decades to come, surpassing 70% by 2020 and approaching 80% in the 2030s. If the scenario of 1% growth and 5% return on capital is correct, the share of inherited wealth could continue to rise, reaching 90% by the 2050s, or approximately the same level as in the Belle Époque. Thus, we see that the U-shaped curve of annual inheritance flows as a proportion of national income in the 20th century went hand in hand with an equally impressive U-shaped curve of accumulated stock of inherited wealth as a proportion of national wealth. In order to understand the relation between these two curves, it is useful to compare the level of inheritance flows to the savings rate, which, as noted in Part 2, is generally around 10% of national income. When the inheritance flow is 20 to 25% of national income, as it was in the 19th century, then the amounts received each year as bequests and gifts are more than twice as large as the flow of new savings. If we add that a part of the new savings comes from the income of inherited capital, indeed, this was the major part of saving in the 19th century, it is clearly inevitable that inherited wealth will largely predominate over saved wealth. Conversely, when the inheritance flow falls to just 5% of national income, or half of new savings, again, assuming a savings rate of 10%, as in the 1950s, it is not surprising that saved capital will dominate inherited capital. The central fact is that the annual inheritance flow surpassed the savings rate again in the 1980s and rose well above it in 2000 to 2010. Today it is nearly 15% of national income, counting both inheritances and gifts. To get a better idea of the sums involved, it may be useful to recall that household disposable monetary income is 70 to 75% of national income in a country like France today, after correcting for transfers in kind, such as health, education, security, public services, etc., not included in disposable income. If we express the inheritance flow not as a proportion of national income, as I have done thus far, but as a proportion of disposable income, we find that the inheritances and gifts received each year by French households amounted to about 20% of their disposable income in the early 2010s. So that, in this sense, inheritance is already as important today as it was in 1820 to 1910. See PDF figure 11.8. As noted in Chapter 5, it is probably better to use national income rather than disposable income as the reference denominator for purposes of spatial and temporal comparison. Nevertheless, the comparison with disposable income reflects today's reality in a more concrete way and shows that inherited wealth already accounts for 1/5 of household monetary resources available for saving, for example, and will soon account for 1/4 or more. Back to Vautrin's lecture. In order to have a more concrete idea of what inheritance represents in different people's lives, and in particular to respond more precisely to the existential question raised by Vautrin's lecture, what sort of life can one hope to live on earned income alone, compared to the life one can lead with inherited wealth? The best way to proceed is to consider things from the point of view of successive generations in France since the beginning of the 19th century, and compare the various resources to which they would have had access in their lifetime. This is the only way to account correctly for the fact that an inheritance is not a resource one receives every year. Consider first the evolution of the share of inheritance in the total resources available to generations born in France in the period 1790 to 2030. See PDF figure 11.9. I proceeded as follows. Starting with series of annual inheritance flows and detailed data concerning ages of the deceased, heirs, gift givers, and gift recipients, I calculated the share of inherited wealth in total available resources as a function of year of birth. Available resources include both inherited wealth, bequests and gifts, and income from labor, less taxes, capitalized over the individual's lifetime using the average net return on capital in each year. Although this is the most reasonable way to approach the question initially, note that it probably leads to a slight underestimate of the share of inheritance, because heirs, and people with large fortunes more generally, are usually able to obtain a higher return on capital than the interest rate paid on savings from earned income. The results obtained are the following. If we look at all people born in France in the 1790s, we find that inheritance accounted for about 24% of the total resources available to them during their lifetimes, so that income from labor accounted for about 76%. For individuals born in the 1810s, the share of inheritance was 25%, leaving 75% for earned income. The same is approximately true for all the cohorts of the 19th century and up to World War I. Note that the 25%